Welcome, everybody. I urge you to turn off your cell phones so that there is no interference. Before introducing the panelists today, I want to just say a few words. The situation today in Iraq, as we know it, the capital especially, is racked by violence. With sectarian killings are at an all-time high, and an insurgency continues to rage. Reconstruction today is stalled by the deteriorating security situation, and the state is weaker than ever. You have some alarming trends, and those include a large number of internally displaced persons, a ghettoization and a homogenization of previously mixed quarters in the cities and and a general deterioration of public services and economic decline. You have figures of up to 60% unemployment that are cited, and most of them affect youth, which constitute youth being under 25, which constitute 65% of the population. You have brain drain, you have rampant corruption, proliferation of militias, and so on. Iraq, however, is suffering from more than just a weak state, one that has lost more than one that has lost both the monopoly on the use of force and has retained little ability to deliver basic services. Iraq has endured, with the reassertion of sectarian and ethnic forces in the new composition of the Iraqi state, the consolidation of identity politics. The new Iraq is one where sectarianism is most crudely evident in the formal distribution of power in government institutions, ministries, for example, which have become party fiefdoms. It is in this context that we note the emergence of arguments in favor of dividing Iraq into three parts, seeing separation as the only solution to violence. But is this solution practicable? Are the forces that divide Iraq stronger than those that unify them? The proponents of a three-state solution rely on arguments about Iraq's frailty as a nation-state and the artificiality of its colonial borders, seeing Iraq as haphazardly cobbled together from the wreckages of the Ottoman Empire. Iraq is viewed as an artificial creation that merges the three provinces of the Ottoman Empire. In the south, the predominantly Arab Shia Basra, in the center, the predominantly Arab Sunni Baghdad, and in the north, the mostly Kurd-inhabited Mosul. These provinces kept united and stable through the strong hand of an authoritarian ruler, and therefore easily deconstructed into its original components. Accordingly, Iraq is said to have failed to generate a national identity greater than the sum of its societal parts. The view freezes a moment of history, the demise of the Ottoman project, treating ethnic purity as the baseline, with 80 years of subsequent history as garnish for a still sectarian reality. Here again, Iraqis are reduced to three monolithic, homogeneous communities driven by unified communal interests. An alternative reading sees the formation of an Iraqi identity during the past 80 years as a byproduct of both a sequence of powerful central governments and the development of an Iraqi common culture that was driven by a dynamic middle class until its attrition in the 80s. Iraq, the nation, therefore, would have acquired a social reality that is replete with renditions of cross-sectarian alliances forged over time across and among Iraqi communities, and of transformed expressions of Iraqi nationhood and nationalism. The proponents of this view consider that the outbreak of sectarianism today does not flow directly from sectarian politics of the previous regime, even though they acknowledge its contribution to the eradication of many of the old forces that tended to be cross-communal and a generation of new ones. As Eric Davis himself has pointed out, Iraq has no history of sectarianism, and really the turn to sectarian identities made its appearance with the post-Gulf War economic decline, and in particular after the collapse of the welfare state. This view also considers that while the potential for ethnic and sectarian tensions may have existed, the emergence of sectarianism after the removal of the Ba'ath regime required a permissive environment in which political actors with expressed sectarian agendas would be able to operate. In a rush to give the transition an Iraqi face, the CPA, for example, empowered sectarian groups whose presence reflected its simplistic view of Iraqi society that consisted of Arabs, Kurds, Shia, and Sunni. One cannot help notice but the hardening of sectarian divisions that came after the demise of the Ba'ath Party, when sect and ethnicity became, for the first time in history, the formal organizing principle in politics. So what lays in store for Iraq? Is fragmentation inevitable? Remember, prior to the Ba'ath rise to power, civil society in Iraq was vibrant, based not on communal identity only, but on economic interests, political networks, and competing ideologies. There were professional unions and associations, writers, artists associations, free press, an extensive coffee house culture. Overlapping ties often brought together members of different ethnic groups and sectarian communities. Moreover, there's lots of evidence to point out to the complexity of Iraqi identity in history, identity politics in history, and the real underlying strength of a genuine Iraqi identity and nationalism, which had nothing to do with ethnic or religious exclusivity and everything to do with cross-fertilization. Can this memory be restored, for example, to counter the distrust among groups, to remind Iraqis of what they have in common? In other words, and I come back to today's panel, what does it mean to be Iraqi today? Is it possible to conceive of a cross-cutting Iraqi identity that would ultimately form the basis of a viable, stable polity? These are questions that our distinguished panel will attempt to address. Eric Davis, professor of political science at Rutgers University and author of a book called Memories of State, Politics, History, and Collective Identity in Modern Iraq, will argue for a more nuanced understanding of identity politics in Iraq and the need to situate sectarian politics, which emerged after 2003 in a specific historical context. Raidar Visser, expert on Shia politics and also author of Basra, the Failed Gulf State Separatism and Nationalism in Southern Iraq, will discuss Iraqi identity and the question of separatism in the South. In doing so, he will scrutinize the ethnic and sectarian units that are being floated today as alternatives to national identity. Phoebe Marr, prominent historian of modern Iraq and former USIP fellow, will delve into Iraq's current ethnic and sectarian picture and discuss the emergence of different political parties and groups within each communal bloc. She will also discuss the role of political leaders and any prospect for confidence building and cross-sectarian compromises among the main groups. Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and Iraq specialist, will offer prescriptions to establish unity. Finally, Nabil El-Tikriti, who is assistant professor of history at the University of Mary Washington, will act as discussant, tying it all together. I will ask the panelists to limit their presentations to 12 minutes, and we will open the floor for Q&A after the presentation. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Patricia. I may be dating myself, but some of you may remember that FedEx ad where the character speaks a mile a minute. I feel like trying to get this all into 12 minutes, I should be proceeding very rapidly. So I'll try to actually cut down on some of my remarks so I can fit within the framework and begin by saying that the title of the presentation today is Conceptualizing Identity Politics in Iraq, the 1990s and After. I want to first start by calling attention to the disconnect between the horrible killings we see in Iraq every day, about 100 Iraqi lives being lost, of course, increasing number of U.S. service personnel, a continued breakdown of the economy, primarily as a result of the deteriorating security situation, and a weak central government that even at times seems, in the form of certain ministries, to be complicit with sectarian killings. I want to juxtapose that presentation or that picture that we have in the media, with on the other hand a historical perspective which would argue for a lack of sectarian traditions in Iraq. Now, I'm not trying to say that there was not sectarianism in Iraq. I remember talking to the late Professor Wadia Jueda at Indiana University, who went to work for the Iraqi Ministry of Defense in the late 1920s, and remembers people there talking about Ash'abiyya and kind of insulting Shia and Iranians. And so we can give a number of examples, people like Salahuddin Sabah, who wrote his memoirs called the Fursan al-Aruba fil Iraq, or the Knights of Arabism in Iraq, and which is a extremely sectarian work. Or, of course, Abdus-Salam Arif, who was one of the conspirators in the 1958 revolution, who was also known for his sectarian commentaries and attitudes. However, I would say that they're really marginal to the general tradition of the Iraqi nationalist movement, which emphasized cross-ethnic cooperation and saw sectarianism really as a colonial and monarchical policy of divide and conquer. At the same time, we also see a lack of religious radicalism in Iraq. If you even look at the fatwas that were issued by the mujtahids against the British during World War I, to go back that far, you'll see that they were defending all of Iraq's peoples, Muslims and Christians alike, Sunni and Shia, and they were thinking about Iraq as a geographically defined entity, a modern nation state, as it were, not a vague Islamic ummah. And really, you didn't have, such as you had in Egypt, where you had the Muslim Brotherhood founded in 1928, you didn't really have the Hizb ut-Dawah founded until the late 1950s, or even perhaps as late as the early 60s, and then largely in response to the fact that so many Shia youth were being attracted by the Iraqi Communist Party, which, needless to say, did not promote a religious or sectarian agenda. So both Sunni Arab and Shi'i communities, Kurdish communities also, have been largely secular throughout the 20th century. And I think most interesting for our discussion today are a number of polls that have recently emerged. For example, the World Values poll that was done by Muadil Mansour at Eastern Michigan University and Mark Tesler at part of the World Values Survey, which has been around for about 20 years now. Going from November 2005 to April 2006, showing definitely a trend away from sectarian thinking. Likewise, the the International Republican Institute poll of July 2006, and the PIPA poll at the University of Maryland in early September of 2006. All of these show continued strong support for democracy among Iraqis, increasing tendency for people, especially in Baghdad, to think of themselves not in sectarian terms, but to think of themselves as Iraqis, and also a desire not for a kind of partition of the country, but a strong central state, especially a strong central state that will suppress the militias. I also want to draw attention to the work by James Fearon and David Layton at Stanford University. Their articles explaining interethnic cooperation in the APSR, American Political Science Review, December of 1996, or more recently, Ethnicity, Insurgency, and Civil War in the APSR, February of 2003, where they find a weak correlation between sectarian conflict and civil strife. They also provide data that shows that in ethnically divided societies, cooperation, not conflict, is the norm, and that a better predictor of conflict is really not cultural, historical grievances, but rather what they call opportunity structures, the collapse of political institutions and the ability of ethnic entrepreneurs, if you will, or sectarian entrepreneurs to be able to utilize these conditions to promote a particular agenda. So let me pose a question. What do we mean by sectarian identities, and why do they attract such interest at the current time? It seems to me that we need first and foremost to address the issue or the concepts of ethnicity and religion themselves in the Iraqi context. Certainly, we can think of ethnicity, if we start there, as incorporating pride. But we know if we go back to 10th and 11th century Andalusia, where there was a lot of ethnic pride among the Arab, Jewish, and Christian communities of the Iberian Peninsula, that pride did not necessarily lead to conflict, but also led to a tremendous cultural synthesis as groups who felt very strongly about their traditions came together to try to share them. I mean, think of our own country, about the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King et al., Southern Christian Leadership Conference. In other words, ethnic pride by in and of itself has no ramifications for necessary ramifications or logical ramifications for conflict. Ethnicity can assume hostile forms, but when it does, I would argue, unlike ethnic pride, that that automatically implies an other. You can't have ethnic hostility unless you are hostile to something else. And so immediately that implies a relationship. And when that relationship goes to a next level, which I would call sectarianism, a more extreme form of ethnic hostility, I think we also have to explain why, under some circumstances, that hostility assumes a violent manifestation and at other times simply remains at the level of intense hostility but does not necessarily create violence. So I don't think the question is just one of understanding ethnic consciousness per se, but rather to understand when it assumes an exclusivist and violent dimension. Religion, it seems to me, is also a category that's been not well conceptualized within the Iraqi context, or many context for that matter. First of all, I think we can look at religion as piety and devotion, the way that most of us would define it. In other words, in the term of religious orthodoxies. If we think about the period after 2003, and we take Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, for example, we see that he has attempted to fight against sectarian violence, has again tried to promote peace and democracy. Democracy in the form of making sure that the plan that L. Paul Bremer, the Coalition Provision Authority administrator, attempted to, in the January 2005 elections, attempted to develop a caucus system that would have excluded all but American approved candidates to run for office. So certainly we think about religion as piety and devotion. That's not sort of a conceptualization that's going to help us understand violence. I think a second conceptualization of religion is it's the idea of religion as the expression of communal identity. I think we see that in the Shia after 2003. First of all, because Saddam had been able to destroy all secular organs of civil society, and the one that he was not able to destroy was the Hausa. The Hausa was not only highly respected because of its opposition to Saddam, but also it had what other organizations did not have, an independent stream of income. Some from donations by Iraqi Shia themselves, but a lot from pilgrims that came to Iraq. So it was, I think in that sense, we're thinking about religion, especially because the Shia had never historically exercised political power and had been oppressed under the Ba'athist regime, that in that sense we had a communal expression, which again does not necessarily imply hostility to any other group. I think what we're really talking about when we're talking about sectarianism, confessionalism, all these terms that are thrown around, is politicized religion. And I would argue here that the causal chain is quite different, that religion is not the starting point, that people start with a group, start with a political agenda, and then mobilize religious symbols defined in sectarian terms to help promote those identities. I think a good example in our own society would be the Ku Klux Klan, and someone who would come here and go back and say, look, I'm going to tell you about Christianity. Well, who did you talk to in the United States when you learned about Christianity? Well, I talked to the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, you would not take the Ku Klux Klan as a defining institution to help us understand sectarian understandings. And I would say that the Southern organization, the Jaish al-Mahdi, for example, is a good instance of this, that Southern himself, while he's constantly stating his uncle's name, Muhammad Bakr al-Sadr, he himself has really never even read those texts and has a relatively superficial understanding of religion. And finally, I would talk about religion as a cover for crime. We know that there was an effort by a lot of Iraqi tribes in Al-Anbar province to fight against certain insurgent groups, and in a February press conference by Sheikh Osama Jad'an, who unfortunately was assassinated on May 29th of this year, pointed out that many of the organizations that claimed that they were, quote-unquote, operating under the banner of Islam were, in fact, covers for crime syndicates. So, since my time is running short, and I'm not going to be able to really go through a lot of my points here, let me sort of jump to the end of my argument, in which I would say to really understand what's going on in Iraq today, I think we have to go to the 1980s, but especially the 1990s, see the type of sectarian regime that Saddam Hussein brought to Iraq after seizing power in 1979, how the framing of the Iran-Iraq war, especially due to the threat that Iraq felt from neighboring Iran, led to the whole Qadisiyat Saddam campaign during that war, how that led to economic decline, how that in turn stimulated the seizure of Kuwait, how that in turn led to the bombing of Iraq, which bombed Iraq back to levels of the industrialization that it had had in the 1960s, how the subsequent February to March 1991 uprising or intifada led by the Iraqi government's own statistics to 300,000 people being killed in the south, primarily Shia, how the UN sanctions regime after that put extreme pressure on the Iraqi poor and pauperized much of the middle class, and in effect destroyed the whole welfare state that had been set up as a result of the 20-fold increase in oil prices between 1970 and 1980. And the collapse of the state, the collapse of the state welfare system, and the collapse of a national market, the collapse of an education or a national education system, tended to push people back into localisms, into regionalism, and into ethnicity and into religion, psychologically in part to escape the horrors of everyday life. And I would say that it was this opportunity structure which led to the rise of sectarian entrepreneurs, of sectarian organizations that under the guise of charity, and of course what do religious organizations do, especially in times of need? They minister to the poor, they minister to the needy, they act as charities, but in effect they were using this opportunity to socialize people, to develop obscurantist ideas such as Muqtada al-Sadr has said that the U.S. forces came to Iraq to prevent the return of the Mahdi. Okay, that's why they're there. And the fact that many so-called clerics were themselves given at that point in time very superficial education. So we also have the state promoting religion at this time. Saddam emphasizing amputations, curtailing women's rights, retribalizing rural areas as a result of killing Ba'athist officials during the Intifada. And if we add to that the blunders of the USCPA, decommissioning 400,000 Iraqi men in the Iraqi army, no new job creation, the emphasis by the CPA itself on sectarian identities, it all suggests, it seems to me, that, first of all, a relatively small segment of the Iraqi population is actively engaged in sectarian violence. Many of these are migrants that come to urban areas because of the collapse of the agrarian system. And the question then becomes, if Leighton and Fearon's data is correct, that usually between 1 and 2% of the Iraqi or populaces that are engaged in insurgent activity, that is our foreign policy and our decisions by the Iraqi government as well being defined then by such a small segment of the population. So it seems to me that ultimately we have a weak state. We have a state that institutionally is very, very unable to really exercise power, that the militias are in effect running many states. And to end, I would simply argue that unless there is an effort on the part of an international community, because there are not enough troops right now that are trained in the Iraqi army, not enough American troops to stem the violence. There has to be more troops in the country. There's simply not enough. There has to also be a massive economic reconstruction plan, which I wrote about recently if anyone's interested. And without these two forces in play that will give people jobs and allow the country to make a move towards apolitical stability and offer people some hope for the future, I do not see an end to the kind of sectarian violence that we see on a daily basis in Iraq. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryder Visser. I will ask panelists to please keep to the 12 minutes allotted.
Thank you. For many years, I've been working on a subject which is called the history of separatism in southern Iraq. And for most of this time, people thought this was an incredibly strange and esoteric subject. And this changed last year in August. And now I find that everyone except me is terribly interested in separatism in southern Iraq. What I'd like to discuss with you today is why I feel this sudden interest in sudden separatism is exaggerated. Let's take a look at the history of separatism in southern Iraq and see what we find. And let's first take just 1 minute to recap the foundation of the Iraqi state in 1921. The standard version is something like this. In 1921, Britain cobbled together three very disparate provinces of the Ottoman Empire into a single unitary state. Shiite Basra in the south, Sunni Baghdad in the center, and Kurdish Mosul in the north. Now, there are two big problems with that account. You've got a leaflet with some maps, and you can have a look at the first of those maps. That concerns this idea about disunity between Basra and Baghdad. You will see from that map there were, in fact, long periods with unity in Ottoman times. And the second problem with that account is on the second map, and it's about this supposed correlation between sect and provincial Ottoman boundaries, which is simply incorrect. That's the map which says distribution of religious and ethnic groups. You see those red lines on that map, those are the Ottoman provincial borders, and you see that those lines cut across ethnic and sectarian divides. They're not overlapping. And let's keep those two points in mind when we go on to look at the history of separatism, which, it has to be said, is not a particularly impressive one. Perhaps the most substantial separatist attempt in the south took place in 1921 in the city of Basra, and that's the first map you have on the next page, marked 1921 to 1928. What happened was that a group of very rich notables and landlords and merchants got together and decided they wanted to have nothing to do with the new Iraqi kingdom. Instead, they wanted some sort of Gulf state, a principality under British protection based on income from commerce, fertile date gardens, and strategic location. Importantly, this project had nothing whatsoever to do with Shiism. This project was headed by Sunni Jews and Christians, and they never managed to appeal to the Shiite population of Basra, and the whole project foundered a few years later. Did the Shiites ever contemplate separatism? Yes, they did, once, and that is on the next page, or next map, which is marked 1927. The background was this. In 1927, many Shiites in Iraq were very concerned about conscription, and they considered all sorts of schemes to escape military service, and the most radical scheme would be to create a separate Shiite state in south of Baghdad. And the leader of this project was a Baghdad politician called Amin Ashashafshi. And he was not a cleric himself, but he was very good at communicating with the ulama. Every week he traveled to Najaf, and he tried and he tried and he tried to make them sign up to this project of his about separating the Shiite areas, and they never signed up to it. But he did succeed in getting the attention from the British intelligence services. They became totally engulfed in this project and thought it was immensely important, wrote lengthy reports. 1 year later, the whole project was gone. It never reemerged. Another interesting thing about this project is that it had virtually nothing to do with Basra. As you see from this map, it had a core area in the middle Euphrates, where it had some support, but it never acquired that level of support in the far south. And that was it. That was the record of separatism in southern Iraq in the 20th century. This is what came to the surface when pressures in Iraqi politics were at their most extreme after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. I think this is an incredibly important point. The Shiites and the population of southern Iraq was never forced into unity with Baghdad. population of southern Iraq opted for unity with Baghdad. Nationalism blossomed in Iraq many years before Saddam Hussein was born. Well, let's move to today's situation and let's look for some parallels. And that's, you can now turn to the page with four maps on it. And you can look at the one which says 2004, bottom left. This was a federal project that was started in the year 2004. And the aim of this project is to establish a single federal entity of three Shiite provinces, Basra, Maysan, and Dikar. And this has some similarities with what we saw in Basra in the 1920s, because this is not a sectarian project as such, it's a regionalist project. It's led by Shiites, but by Shiites who want to separate from other Shiites. They said they're tired of being dominated by the political leadership of the big Shiite parties, which is dominated by persons from Baghdad, from Najaf and Karbala. And they want some control of the oil in this area. Remember that 99% of all Shiite oil is within this small triangle. There's no oil in Najaf. The more famous Shiite federal project was launched last year, as I said, and that's on the next page, the now very famous model of a single Shiite region of nine provinces south of Baghdad. It's explicitly sectarian. It's headed by the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, Sghiri, and the basic idea and its slogan is that federalism will create security against terrorism. And there's some striking parallels between this scheme and the one from 1927. These politicians are also trying and trying and trying to get the support of the ulama, but they still haven't got it, certainly not from Sistani. Second, they have some backing in central Iraq, particularly in Najaf, but they have big problems in the far south, where there is this separate regional project. Another similarity is that outsiders are extremely interested in this project. It's not the Royal Air Force this time, it's the Western media industry. On the other hand, it's much more difficult to find solid evidence of popular support for it. So if this is all that is to report about regionalist and separatist tendencies in Iraqi politics today, does that mean that Iraqi nationalism is alive and healthy and well? Well, obviously not. But I think it's much more alive than media is reporting. Inside the United Iraqi Alliance, there are many, there are large segments of politicians who are not particularly keen on this vision of a single Shiite region. But a few weeks ago, something very important happened. That was the appointment of the committee charged with revising the Iraqi constitution. Sghiri, who promotes this sectarian federalism, managed to capture a very large chunk of the Shiite seats in that committee. And this means that this committee is probably not going to become a forum that will reverse the decision to implement federalism in Iraq. It will probably not be an avenue for resuscitating Iraqi nationalism. So how did we get into this situation? If the separatist forces in Iraqi politics are in fact quite weak on the ground, why are they so influential at the elite level? Well, there are some crucial differences here from 1927. First, a strong regional power, Iran, is supporting the federalists. Second, there's also an extremist Sunni organization who wants exactly this sort of outcome. Al-Qaeda, they are trying through their terrorism to goad the Shiites into adopting exactly this sort of formula And they are hoping it will be established, because that would be constitute ultimate proof to them that they could prove to the world that the United States is pursuing what I call, would call a Zionist agenda in the Middle East, dividing the region into small and weak statelets, and so on. Thank you. And thirdly, it's this media factor. In contrast to the Royal Air Force in the 1920s, the media today are amplifying this federalist project for a global audience. So it gets blown out of proportion to its real influence. And the result is that this idea about a separate Shiite federal entity enjoys enormous prominence in so-called alternative policy debates in the United States and elsewhere today. And what I find absolutely astonishing about this is that whereas the existing Iraqi state structure is subjected to much scrutiny, hardly any critical questions are being asked about these replacement units that are now being floated. Are they any more viable, robust, and capable of delivering security to their citizens? What is their track record? What is their history? Well, we've just looked at it. They are parenthetical. How can we be so sure that a single Shiite federal entity will not break down further into smaller regional units? How can we know that Shiite factions like the Sadrists and Skiria will stop fighting each other? How can we know that they will be able to withstand domination by Iran? These are questions I think should be kept in mind before one starts dismantling the Iraqi state structure. Thank you.
Thank you, Raider. Phoebe?
Well, it's always nice to be back at USIP, but I keep having this feeling in Washington that I'm carrying coals to Newcastle because it's so difficult, really, to tell anyone in this town anything that they haven't already read. But I've been asked by Pat to deal with where Iraqi identity is now. Is there any left? Is there enough left to have Iraq remain a single state? Or will it divide into three parts, many parts? In my view, probably the latter, long before the former. Perhaps, why is it so hard to reconcile? This is a very slippery subject, like jello. It changes daily. Anyone who wants to deal with identity knows that. But I've been involved for the last 2 years, thanks to USIP, in a study of the emerging Iraqi leaders. So unlike Rader, who is quite appropriately focused on kind of the grassroots, which is interesting, I'm going to be dealing with the leaders who are making these decisions, however well they're going to, or ill, they're going to be able to apply them. But I'd like to make a couple of comments about the situation before I get to the leaders. I've said before, but I'll say again, in trying to explain Iraq and where it is today in terms of identity or anything else, to my mind, Iraq has gone through and is going through two profound revolutions, nothing short of revolutions. One is a domestic revolution in leadership. An entirely new group of leaders is now in power, and I think we have to recognize how revolutionary that is, whether or not they remain, whether there's further transition or whatever. Second, we see in progress now a revolution in the form of the state. The state itself may collapse, and in any event, we're going to have a highly decentralized form of government, which may, be based on ethnic and sectarian identity. I would like to even cast the problem further. Seems to me, as a historian, when I look back and look at what is happening today, we may be seeing in the Middle East, especially the Fertile Crescent, the end of the First World War dispensation of states and power, because we now have a very big state some trouble. We've just had an episode in Lebanon, which indicates frailty there. Need I mention Palestine, the Israeli-Arab issue? So this is a problem strategically. we need to be very aware of, because we may be at one of these very substantial watersheds. These revolutions in Iraq are still inconclusive, especially the second one, wither the state, but we certainly do need to be prepared for it. How do we get here? My colleagues have already asked the question, is ethnic and sectarian identity in Iraq primordial, longstanding? I'm going to talk about the Kurds today, which everybody seems to leave out, but I'm not going to because I consider them part of the equation. Kurdish identity, particularly based on language, has more legs to stand on and has a longer history, although even there I would suggest there have been multiple identities, including in some periods a loyalty to Iraq. But certainly with the so-called Shia and Sunni Arabs, their identity has always intersected with other identities, ideological, urban tribal divisions, and so on. Now, without going into detail, let me make another point. This issue of communal identity, particularly sectarian in my view, is today not primordial, but is driven by politics, political leaders, and political parties. To put it simply, the removal of the regime has created a political vacuum for all to see. The U.S., if they were going to rearrange Iraq, needed to get new leaders, replace the old ones. Ultimately, elections of some sort were going to be the only acceptable way, and as we can see, this fueled the process of communal identity. The new leaders needed to mobilize the population in a culture, a political culture, without a history of civic politics. And many of them, some of them, benefited from the political vacuum. As always happens, the best organized, the best financed, were able to gain power and establish an identity. The U.S., in large measure, has focused Iraqis on the political process, democracy, if you like, on elections. And although this may have been inevitable, it has helped fuel the process. We now have new and different leaders who are drawing on and emphasizing different narratives and different myths to strengthen, not to weaken, this identity. I agree that the polls, such as they are, and I don't put too much emphasis on polls in modern-day Iraq, but the polls do show that the population, for the most part, does not want division. They indicate the population wants security, economic development, services. In short, it wants government. The leaders, with the exception of the Kurds recently, have not been concentrating on this. Now, third point, let me just share with you some of the results that I'm and the conclusions I'm coming to with my study of leaders. Three points I would like to make about the new leadership. There has been a complete change in the ethnic and sectarian background of the leadership from Saddam's time, and as we know, the dominance of the Sunnis, particularly the Sunnis from small towns in the Sunni triangle, are gone. And in fact, the leadership does fairly accurately represent the disposition of these communities in Iraq. But it hasn't, of course, eliminated ethnic and sectarian differences. I think two other factors are important in this leadership that feed into this ethnic and sectarian identity. One is the insider-outsider divide, the exiles versus those who lived in Saddam's Iraq. In my study, I found, as far as I can tell, at least half of these new leaders are exiles, many of whom have spent time in neighboring countries, or, in the case of the Kurds, have been in the north for at least a decade or more, free of Saddam's control. They've had different experiences, different narratives that they're bringing to bear. The insiders who remained in Iraq have been very slow to come into power. Third, and I think most important in understanding what's going on, is that many of these leaders, especially the most important ones, have spent most of their active life in opposition to Saddam's regime. They've been persecuted, lost relatives, etc. This is true even of the Sunnis now in the leadership. Very few who have served in the previous regime have yet made it into power. They feel disenfranchised. The Sunnis will tell you that although I'm willing to participate, I'm seen because I'm Sunni as part of the old regime. Shia, of whom there were many who participated in the old regime, are now assumed to have a new loyalty, which is Shia. Now, let me try to not use up too much of my time by moving on to try to draw a political map of where the identity stands with these leaders. I asked about five key issues in my study. What is your identity? How do you see the future government of Iraq? How do you feel about religion in the state? How important is economics? And what's your attitude toward foreign powers and your neighbors? Now, let me talk a bit about the Kurds. I found, incidentally, regrettably, that in this new crop of leaders, there was more that divided them than brought them together, although there are some things on which you can have cross-communal agreement, and we should be looking for those and encouraging them. The Kurds, who are quiet at the moment, are not a problem, are almost factored out of the equation. But the role of the Kurdish parties, not Kurdistan, but the Kurdish parties, is critical. They are providing a model, but they may also be driving much of this separatism. The Kurds, as we know, have a fairly, these leaders have a fairly cohesive view on Iraq, and it's nationalist. On identity, they have first a Kurdish identity rather than an Iraqi identity, which they would like to spread to other areas, such as Kirkuk. And while the leaders recognize that they stand more to gain in staying in Iraq than leaving it, this is a fairly pragmatic attitude. I'm not so sure of many of the younger generation, which does not speak Arabic. In terms of government and how they see the future government, they're focused on federalism. And incidentally, it's not entirely democratic up in the north either, because these two parties have an iron grip on the region, and indeed, the separation of the two parties in their regions has not been erased. On religion, the Kurds are the most secular of any group. On economic development, now that they have some stability, they are moving in the direction of economic development, particularly trying to get foreign investment. And on occupation and the foreign powers, they are pro-U.S. This vision separates Kurds from much of the rest of Iraq on major issues, and hence it's very difficult to reconcile. But the Kurds have a lot of virtues that are needed in the rest of Iraq in the central government. They're the main experienced politicians. They're open to the outside, willing to cooperate with the U.S., and so on. The key here is getting them to commit to Baghdad and the central government. We need to do more to bring the Kurds into Iraq and, to put it briefly, not to let them get away. Now, the Shia. Unlike the Kurds, there is little homogeneity among these Shia leaders, more variety, more ambiguity in responses. But some themes come through. There is a sense of Iraqi identity among Kurdish leaders, but not so strongly. It's mixed with other identities, and it seems to me, particularly with these exile groups, that the Shia identity is becoming stronger. On the nature of government, not surprisingly, the Shia support elections and majoritarian role. There are distinct differences, however, on federalism. Sidi, as is mentioned, supports a nine-province area in the south. There's strong evidence that few are the Shia parties. The Da'wah, and certainly not the Sadrist, Fadila, and so on, do not. However, Shia do not, in general, Shia leaders do not want a strong central government. Third, on religion, although this isn't at the top of their minds now, getting and keeping power is, I found when I really talked to most of these Shia religio-political party leaders that ultimately that was really their interest in Islamizing society. They have a variety of views on the extent to which they want the clergy involved. Hakim wants more than others, and there is diversity there. They are not the least bit interested in economics, and on occupation, they'll tolerate our support as long as we support them. The Sunnis are still in shock and denial over removal of the party. They are the quintessential insiders who have not been let in. Identity is a problem for the Sunnis. They are essentially nationalist, Arab, religious. Getting them to feel Sunni has been difficult. On the state of the government, however, they're much clearer. They want a unified Iraq, a strong central government, a rule of law, and security. On religion, they're mixed. Some are more religious, some are more secular. So that is an issue which cuts across sectarian lines. Again, on economics, there's no thought there. They are opposed to occupation, but they're changing. They now see the critical enemy as Iran rather than the United States. Now, the last point I would like to make at Patricia's patience, I hope, is to call attention to a third trend which is emerging. It's fragile, it's weak, but it's important. And that is the political fragmentation of these blocs, particularly the Shia and the Sunni. It's political parties, backed by militias, agreed, which are not a good factor, that is emerging. And it is these parties and their distinctive views which are going to determine direction. Among the Shia, Sirri, which has a certain view on federalism and on other things. The Sadrists. Sirri, incidentally, represents more the middle class. I find middle class attaching themselves to Sirri. Sadr represents the poor, those who have not benefited since 2003, has a distinct point of view on occupation, on federalism, if it's the same view today as tomorrow. The Da'wah is another group, and we're seeing further splintering among the Shia community. The Sunnis, particularly even those in power, are split. The Tawafiq Alliance, on the one hand, mainly backed by the IIP, Iraqi Islamic Party, and Mutlaq, which is secular, to say nothing of the different groups that are splintering in the insurgency. This should not be looked at, in my view, as a problem, but an opportunity. And the last point I would make is that if we're looking for ways in which to keep Iraq together in this tenuous state, is to look at the parties, not the ethnic and sectarian groups, and to get them to cooperate on issues, issue by issue, across ethnic and sectarian lines. Again, these are difficult to find, but economic development is one of them. This should be raised to the top priority. Oil, getting some kind of a comprehensive national oil law that satisfies both parties. Water resources, irrigation to the south, for example. The environment, human rights. And on those critical issues like federalism, in which there is a great deal of division, better to postpone it for the time. In conclusion, I'd simply say I'm not terribly optimistic. What you see today is what you're going to get. I don't see a real change soon. There isn't a clear outcome, but Iraq will be better off working across ethnic and sectarian lines on issues on which people can be brought together with a certain degree of patience than it will throwing up our hands and saying, let's divide this into regions where I agree with Radar, there's no evidence that they're going to be more stable and certainly no evidence that it's going to damp down ethnic and sectarian strife.
Thank you, Phoebe. Mike.
About 15 years ago when I was applying to college, remember Harvard University had an admissions essay asking what your greatest personal attribute was. Someone wrote back with just one word, sent in their essay, brevity, and they got in. I didn't get in, but I'll still try to hold it to around 12 minutes. At any rate, I just want to make a couple historical points and then go into some of the nuts and bolts about different pressure points that the international community might consider to help encourage the fusion of Iraqi nationalism once again. First of all, when I did my doctoral research, my doctorate's in Iranian history, and I worked on specifically the 19th century and about the introduction of telegraphy to Iran, and I just say that to watch everyone's eyes glaze over. But part of my dissertation work involved in the archives looking at the Ottoman-Persian diplomatic correspondence from the 19th century to look at how the telegraph was used, look at the interaction between the two countries, and so forth. And one of the issues which became clear in the Persian diplomatic archives, in the Iranian diplomatic archives, is even though, again, people often talk about how Iraq was patched together artificially by Gertrude Bell from three Ottoman provinces, there was still in the 19th century a concept that there was something more there than just three Ottoman provinces. There was a concept of Iraq. The analogy I would make is the way sometimes people talk about Palestine or Kurdistan. Perhaps there's not formal diplomatic borders yet, but the fact of the matter is there's a general consensus that there's something there, a concept. And to some extent, Iraq predates the 80 years of its independence, 85 years of its independence, depending on how you want to chart these things. And this goes also for the Kurds. If you look at the 1880s and you look at the Ubaydullah rebellion, it was just seen as a tribal problem rather than a national problem. All too often, people try to write nationalism back retroactively. At any rate, going into Iraq in 2003, it's clear that the United States, perhaps the one issue the United States most underestimated, or misunderestimated, if you will, was the psychological impact of occupation. What the Iranians, on the other hand, most misunderestimated was the psychological impact of Iraqi nationalism. And this is something that I'm afraid sometimes we are afraid to point out as much as we should. When you look at, compare the Iraqi media network with al-Sharqiyya, which started up on its own under Saad al-Bazaz around the same time, one of the reasons why al-Sharqiyya became so popular was it wasn't afraid to play the nationalist card. It wasn't afraid to use satire. And the fact of the matter is, if some of these militias are seen by many Iraqis as anti-Iraqi nationalism, as proxies of a hidden hand, if you will, there's no reason why this shouldn't be pointed out a little bit more. If not by us, we shouldn't stand in the way of Iraqis playing the Iraqi nationalist card and pointing this out. Perception in the Middle East oftentimes is more important than reality. I was in a meeting with Iraqi Ba'athist insurgents, former military officers, and Shia tribal leaders from southern Iraq last month. And there's one common complaint, and it's a conspiracy theory, but it's that the United States is purposely striking a deal to hand over Iraq to Iran. After all, just like we're purposely denying Iraq electricity, you can land a man on the moon, but you can't turn the lights on. How can you spend billions of dollars, have almost 2,800 Americans sacrificed, have many more Iraqis sacrificed, and let this turn out the way it's turning out? There's starting to be a backlash that's playing in favor of Iraqi nationalism right now. And all too often, we do play the Iraqi ethnic and sectarian card a little bit too much. Iraqis used to joke about the Coalition Provisional Authority. Did you hear about how the Americans put together the Iraqi soccer team? In the first half, the goalie has to be a Shia Turkmen. In the second half, Sunni Turkmen. You got to rotate a Shia Thali Kurd in for every Sunni Arab you take out, and vice versa, and so forth. We did that a little bit too much. That said, when you go down to a place like Kirkuk, that's often seen in an ethnic sectarian lens. People always used to talk Kurd versus Turkmen, although in reality recently it's been Shiite versus Kurd, and so forth. But in reality, we see that in an ethnic and sectarian lens. If you go down to Najaf, this was before the elections, the biggest division in Najaf was between the traditional Najafis and those who flocked in from the countryside after the 1991 Intifada. Because under original Iraqi law, you could vote wherever you had been for 3 years. And people in Najaf didn't want the election to change, to legitimate a change in the traditional character of Najaf. Well, this is Shiite on Shiite. It has to do with local culture. It doesn't have to do with ethnicity or sectarian preference, so to speak. And therefore, sometimes we need to stop imposing our sectarianism and our ethnocentrism upon others. Not everyone sees things in the same lens. But there's no doubt that today, of course, in Iraq, there are real ethnic and sectarian strains. So I'm going to talk about that for a second. The last thing I want to do, though, is say when I go to the South, what I always try to do is what I call the scrap metal test. That if I'm a businessman, and I don't do business, I'll talk to the scrap metal dealers. If you have scrap metal, lucrative trade, and you want to export it, who do you have to go to? Who do you have to talk to? Who do you have to get the permits from? It really gives an idea of who's in power where. Do you just go and get a permit from the central government, or do you have to go to the Jaish al-Mahdi here, or to the Badr Corps there, and so forth? And in reality, I would second what was said before, that oftentimes what we're talking about are crime syndicates rather than ethnic or sectarian groups, and we've got to recognize that. Iraqis are not incapable of democracy. According to the Guardian newspaper of London, one out of every six Iraqis fled Iraq under the time of Saddam Hussein. Among those that settled in the West, they had no cultural impediment to democracy, which leads me to argue that the problem is rule of law. This is what scares me about some of the policy policy prescriptions which are out there and are being bantied around. If you have a problem with rule of law, the last thing I'd argue you want to do is create a vacuum. Militias will fill that vacuum. Why do militias exist? Militias exist to impose through force at the point of a gun, what they can't necessarily get through a ballot box. And when we're talking about the nature of political parties in Iraq, this is one trend which Karina Pirelli, the UN election specialist, had talked about prior to the setup of the elections in Iraq, which was in polls across Iraq, and this was quoted in the Washington Post, political parties only have about a 3% favorability rating. 3%. This brings me to one of those issues which I want to discuss. And the United States, it's all too often to sit in a boardroom and pretend that we can just impose our will here. So what I'm trying to do is identify pressure points to encourage. We're not the Coalition Provisional Authority. We're not Paul Bremer. Jerry Bremer. We can't just impose. But one of the biggest mistakes I would argue that was made that's not talked about is over the nature of elections. The nature of elections, you have different dichotomies you can choose. On one hand, direct elections. On the other hand, proportional representation. The first past the post or the proportion. The way it's set up now is for every, something like 0.4% of the vote, one person gets in, and you have a party list. Well, the problem when you do an election like that is instead of having a constituency, which one is loyal to, you're loyal to whoever the head of that political party is. So what it does is it encourages ethnic separatism. It encourages sectarian identity, because what you want to do is play the populist card, because the people are going to vote across the region on that. There's no particular representative for any particular district, so the debate isn't about who can get the electricity up and running, who can protect the pipeline, who can fix the sewer systems. Democracy is about accountability. So the way I would sum up this question is, how in Iraq are you going to have a system where the politicians are made accountable to constituencies and to the people? And are those constituencies only going to be ethnic or sectarian constituencies? I should note that this issue was faced by Jordan about 15 years ago. And after the Muslim Brotherhood had done remarkably well, I think this was in the last years of King Hussein, instead of banning the Muslim Brotherhood, what King Hussein did was double the number of election districts. And what happened was the Muslim Brotherhood lost half their seats. So what he found is when you treat the whole nation, and Iraq changed this slightly in their last election, as a single election district, people vote on religion. When you break down the units a little bit more, people tend to discuss more tribalism or some of the local identity issues. And when you break down those districts even further, then you get debates over who can fix the pipes, who can fix the pylons, and so forth. Number two, Iraqi security forces. We're in a catch-22 here for U.S. policy. A lot of people conflate the Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi police. They're two different things, and as critical as I've been of General Petraeus at times in my past writing and so forth, I'll have to step back and say that people did a remarkably good job so far with the Iraqi security forces and where we are. There's still a while to go. We still need to talk much more about logistics and so forth, independence of logistics. But the reason why we've had some modicum of success with the Iraqi security forces is coalition forces have been embedded with them from every level, from the foot soldier all the way up to dispatch and headquarters. The police, on the other hand, are completely out of control. When I'm in Baghdad, every time I come to a police checkpoint, that's the only time I'm scared. So I don't know who the heck those guys are. Well, the fact of the matter is, when asked the question, why don't we do what's worked at least a bit, perhaps too late, but a bit, with the Iraqi security forces, with the Iraqi police? And the reason is because while the security forces have well-protected military bases, the Iraqi police stations are exposed, and it's not secure enough to really embed personnel with them. Well, this becomes a catch-22, that it's not secure enough to embed people at every level. Therefore, the police are out of control because they're basically another name for death squads in many cases. Well, this is a catch-22 that's somehow got to be broken, because the fact of the matter is what we've learned with the militias all along is if you let the problem metastasize, it ain't going to get any better. let me talk again about the militias, and I want to go into this whole issue of over-ethnic, of seeing Iraq too much through an ethnic or sectarian prism. Oftentimes we talk about the Sunni strategy, how to bring the Sunnis in. Sorry, this is part of the problem. We talk very little about Iraqi strategies, all too much about Sunni strategies. The worst idea out there right now, but the rumors are rife, is that the United States, for example, would support the militia of the Iraqi Islamic Party to counterbalance some of the other Shiite militias which are out there. If that is true, it is an absolute idiotic decision. We've got to start thinking not just in the short term, but in the long term. Too much short-term thinking creates sometimes more problems than it's worth. And this goes into some of the other ideas which are being bantered about there. Look, when it comes to the idea of inviting other countries in to stabilize, first of all, this is an insult to Iraqi nationalism. If one talks to Iraqis, they don't like being treated as a petri dish. Whatever Iraqi, I don't talk for Iraqis, I'm not Iraqi, but across the board, this becomes a problem. The Taif Accords are not a model to implement. Iraqis tend not to look very favorably upon any of their neighbors. And the idea that any of the neighbors would be trusted to stabilize Iraq, unfortunately, is quite naive. When it comes to the issue of Turkey and the Kurds, I would just point out that I think the strategy which many of the Iraqi Kurds are using is particularly good, and that is, if you want long-term peace and stability, integrate the Iraqi economy, the Iraqi Kurdish economy, into the Turkish economy as much as possible, and this can be extended to the Jordanian economy and so forth, because that's the way you can really have long-term stability and to stop some of the interference. But to just hand over Iraq to, I mean, basically to let the fox guard the hen house, not sure that it's that productive. And let's also call arguing for the breakup of Iraq what it is. First of all, it's all well and good to argue for, it's easy to argue for the breakup of Iraq, especially if you're paid by the Kurdistan Regional Government or if you have significant interest in some Norwegian oil companies. And sometimes people need to look a little bit more into motivations of some of these breakup theories. But the fact of the matter is, it would be akin to at least turning a blind eye to attempted genocide, because when you go to Basra, it used to be, what, 10-15% Sunni Arab? When you look at Fallujah, when the trouble started, 10% Kurdish. When you go to a place like Tuz Hormatu or Kirkuk or Baghdad, it's an incredibly mixed area. Right now, over the last week, we've had problems with Muqtada al-Sadr's thugs, militias, coming into Mansour, one of the upper middle class business districts of Baghdad, and trying to promote this sort of ethnic cleansing, at least giving warnings of what's to come. This is what needs to be rolled back. Creating a vacuum is not going to cut it. Turning around and leaving isn't going to cut it. It seems, unfortunately, and I say this in conclusion, that we tend to underestimate, at first I said it was only the Iranians who underestimated Iraqi nationalism. We tend to underestimate Iraqi nationalism to a great extent, too. Unfortunately, through significant arrogance, assuming that Iraqi nationalism is less than meets the eye, we're in danger of creating a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is going to have remarkable complications and remarkable cost of blood if it's allowed to continue. The problems are the militias and the problems are rule of law, and the solution shouldn't be to create a vacuum, but very succinctly to address the issue of rule of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Nabil?
As discussant, I did not come in with many prepared comments. I've just been trying to riff on what the others have been saying. And I can say for the first time in a very long time, and perhaps the first time ever, I actually found very little to disagree with. This was quite remarkable in a group of four different scholars coming from such varied backgrounds. So I'm actually not going to be criticizing so much as just fleshing out and trying to make the main points and adding my own 2 cents worth on a couple of things. Regarding Iraqi identity, is there really such a thing? You can slice it up many different ways. You can slice it up as Iraqi nationalism, pan-Arabism, pan-Shiism, pan-Ottomanism back in the day, which didn't die out really until the end of the 1920s or 1930s. You can have a pan-Islamic vision, a pan-Kurdish vision. All of those are possible. And all of those are in existence in today's Iraq. And it's true, what all of the panelists have pointed out is that Iraqi nationalism amongst that mix has been underestimated and really is quite a bit stronger, at least in the mindset of most urban middle-class Iraqis, if nothing else, as well as in the mindset of the micro-minorities that have not really been addressed with here. And I think the micro-minorities get short shrift partially because you're only given 12 minutes and nobody's really specializing them on this panel. But if there is a failing of any of these presentations, is that nobody's really discussed the Assyrians or the Turkoman, the Assyrio-Chaldeans, the various other groups like Sabaeans, Yazidis. They are out there, and a lot of them are emigrating. And basically, Iraq is kind of becoming a homogenizing entity right before our very eyes. It's not only losing a great deal of population, it seems, but it's also homogenizing and kind of reshuffling its identity as we speak. And that's very problematic, very violent, and likely not to turn out very well. So is there an Iraqi identity? I think there is. And I think that you can go back to long before the 20th century to find origins of it. And some points that I want to bring up on that is that there is such a thing as the two Iraqs, going all the way back to at least the 13th century, and I think probably much earlier than the 13th century, where there is Iraqi Ajam and Iraqi Arab. And today's Iraq is more or less Iraqi Arab. And that term was in currency well into the 16th century, because when the Ottomans conquered today's Iraq, that's what they referred to the campaign as, the campaign of the two Iraqs. Also, we talk frequently of the three provinces, but there's really, you can argue, five provinces that were run from the primacy of Baghdad for much of the Ottoman period. And the two that are kind of forgotten, one more clearly than the other, is Shahrazur, which was an overwhelmingly Assyrian and Kurdish province throughout its history, which went in and out of existence as the Ottomans and the Safavids were in primacy, and eventually got reorganized and melted into Mosul and Baghdad. And the other one is less arguably in the mix, but El-Hasa, or Lahza in Turkish. And I say it's less logically in the mix because while it was kind of ruled as an extension of Basra, I don't know that you'd really argue very strongly that they belong in some Iraqi identity sense, in any deep sense. So now to summarize the major points that I think were especially valuable for each of these papers. From Eric Davis, he's attributing the current situation largely to the legacies of the last 20 to 30 years prior to the U.S. invasion, combined with the CPA mistakes. And I think the concept of politicized religion is an extremely valuable concept to keep in mind. The idea that various groups have political agendas and they're using the cloak of religion to secure those political agendas is a very valuable a point that I completely agree with. And the only minor critique I might have of the presentation is in that 20, 30-year period leading up to 2003, the agency of the U.S. and other Western powers is not really being addressed in the discussion, although I'm certain it could be. Moving on to writer Visser, the point that Iraqi nationalism is very much alive, and aside from, well, as with the exception of Kurds, I think, would be the main point. Iraqi nationalism amongst Sunni and Shi'i Arabs is very much alive. And he shows this as much in his writings as in the presentation itself. He demonstrates this quite strongly, and I think I again completely agree. The only thing that could have been added to it was again the subgroups, Kurdish aspirations and their effect on Assyrians within Kurdish regions, for example. With Phoebe Marr, the point about the leadership changing and the revolution of the state, again, complete agreement. And the idea of political fragmentation within these groups as being an opportunity is another point that I think we should take from this and keep in mind for its policy prescriptions, because that political fragmentation is an opportunity for the potential sort of bringing back together of Iraq from the abyss, or at least it's one part of the mix of bringing Iraq back from the abyss, which actually it seems like it's entering, but that's another point. And again, I'm thinking about the microgroups, I've already mentioned that point. The idea of economic development as a prime focus from here on out, while I agree with, I somehow feel that security kind of has to come first, because it's hard to imagine economic development in a chaotic vacuum that we're seeing today. At the same time, once you have some semblance of security, economic development, or at least the promise of economic development, has to follow immediately. At least there has to be something for people to look forward to. And then on the last talk, Michael Rubin, I was shocked, I say, to find that I agreed on every single point, which I would not have expected from your writings, because I did my homework, so to speak. And again, enthusiastic agreement on every single point, namely that the concept of Iraq did exist, such as other regions like Palestine and Kurdistan. It does have a proto-existence going way back. And it was referred to as such long before, and the idea that identities shift. The examples of Sheikh Ubaydullah, seen as a tribal, not a national problem in the 1880s. It's a classic case, whereas if it were today, it would be seen as a Kurdish struggle, and you can look back at it that way if you choose to, but that's not what the people living it themselves necessarily saw as they were living it. And I think you can see that with many other ways that history is being written about Ottoman Iraq and even pre-Ottoman Iraq. The idea of the U.S. underestimating the psychological impact of occupation, it's obvious and it's still true. There's sort of a disconnect there vis-a-vis Americans. You know, the idea that, well, okay, there's an army. The army's from halfway around the world. There's 140,000 of them, and there's only 25 million of us. Project that, flip the scenario around. Imagine if some army were to do that in the U.S. and then say, okay, well, let's see, who are we going to appoint in power? You know, you sort of imagine Al Sharpton, Louis Farrakhan, and a couple of other Black Panthers being basically appointed to run the country on sectarian identity, and imagine what that would do to the U.S. political scene. I think you would have violence very quickly if the scenario were flipped, and there is a disconnect there because Americans have never been occupied, I suppose, or at least certainly not in living memory. So there is a disconnect there, and they just don't see it. It's like a blind spot. The Iranians underestimating Iraqi nationalism, also an absolutely valid point, because Iraqi nationalism is alive and well, at least with certain important sectors. And by that I mean the urban middle class and the smaller sort of ethnic and religious groups. Finally, the point about the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan and the idea of splitting up the districts, that's genius. And it's almost the idea of don't try and control freak a society. Let the society sort of run its natural course, and sometimes things will turn out better if you just engineer things in a certain way in terms of boundaries, in a way that's much better than trying to sort of reform at the through the barrel of a gun. I think on that note, my riffing on what all of you wonderful panelists said will come to an end, and I congratulate you because I did not expect it to go quite so smoothly and quite so in agreement, I felt. Thank you.
Thank you, Nabil. I will open the floor for questions, but I would like to ask you to really keep your questions to questions and not to make any comments. If you would go up to the microphone and ask your questions. Anybody?
I had a question for Professor Maher or anyone. Just given the recent statements that Barzani made about the Iraqi flag and just some of the actions of the Kurds, it almost seems as though they're biding time before they announce their independence. Do you think that could happen, if not in the next year, when the U.S. troops leave?
Let me start a discussion on that. I know Michael has had a lot of experience up there, too, and he might want to join in. It's not only the United States that has a difference in between reality and what they'd like to have. It seems to me that the Kurds, some of the Kurds certainly would like to put in place the bones of of independence, just in case at some point they might be able to pull something like Kosovo. But there's a great deal of difference between what you want and what you're likely to get. And let me just state a couple of things about the potential for Kurdish independence. The leaders that I'm talking to, I can't speak for the population because I'm dealing with the leaders, are more experienced than many of others in Baghdad. That many of them are well-traveled. They know the West. They have, I think they have a better sense of what's realistic and possible. There are many impediments to just seceding from Iraq and declaring independence. Where are the Kurds going to go? Number one, if you want to be independent, you have to get recognition. That's going to be a very big problem for the Kurds, certainly with respect to their neighbors. They are landlocked, and they have to get their goods out. Michael talked about trade and so on. The Turks could close the border, at any time. The Kurds are doing very well in maintaining security domestically in the north, but they cannot control their borders. We need to keep that in mind. The PKK is all along the northern border. There was a time when the PUK couldn't control the border with Iran, and we saw fundamentalists emerge there. And last but not least, to really get real economic development and the oil that they aspire to going in the north, they're going to need massive foreign investment, particularly on the oil industry. Foreign investment is not going to go into this area until there is some kind of stable legal framework there. So there are many, many more impediments to just seceding and declaring independence. However, at the moment, when the Kurds look down in Baghdad, understandably they don't like what they see. There has to be positive incentive for the Kurds to... They're staying in Iraq. They're in Iraq. The president of Iraq is a Kurd. Some of the most substantial politicians down in Baghdad are Kurds. What I'm arguing for is that the Kurdish development is has provided a fairly good model up in the north, which is one of the things other people like Citi would like to replicate. We need to think of ways in which we can get the Kurds to contribute more to an emerging Iraq rather than thinking of how they can get out of it.
Eric?
Yeah, I just want to add one other dimension. I think this is all multifaceted to build on what Phoebe said. I think that, first of all, one is to realize that this whole flag issue came up during the time of the Anfal trials. Okay, that's an extremely sensitive topic in Kurdistan. And if you take into account the fact that you do have rising Islamist sentiment in Kurdistan because you have many of the same problems that you have in the south replicating themselves in Kurdistan, no jobs for young people, tremendous nepotism, control of all sorts of patronage by especially the KDP but also by the PUK, that one way of bringing this issue up on the part of Barzani, and I'm not saying that's the sole factor, but I think that certainly fit in, given also the kinds of demonstration by Kurds against their own government at the Halabja Memorial last March. One has to also see this, I think, in instrumental terms as much as simply a kind of patriotic expression of opposition to the Iraqi flag. And by the way, just one other comment, there is another Iraqi flag around. It's the flag that Qasem, Abdelkarim Qasem developed after 1958, which really does not privilege any one ethnic group at all.
I forgot. I want to say that I would like people to introduce themselves too before they ask their question. But in this case, I would like to introduce Mishkat Mo'min, who is the former Minister of the Environment, and thank you for coming.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. My question is for Professor Davis or any of the great panelists. Do you think that the geopolitics of Iraq can play a role in identifying the Iraqi identity? And by geopolitics, I mean Iraq location. Iraq is a small country surrounded by bigger countries that have interest in Iraq. And I would like your comments on that.
Well, actually, I'm doing some research on looking at democratic transitions in Spain, Serbia, and Iraq with a graduate student of mine who's a specialist on Serbia. And the reason we chose Spain is because Spain is held up as the kind of quintessential democratic transition and consolidation. But I think the point that I'm trying to make here and addresses your issue is the whole concept of neighborhood effects. because you have a period of time in the 60s and 70s in which Spain, through many Spaniards going off to other European countries to work, is bringing back ideas of democracy and tolerance. But I think oftentimes we lose sight of the fact that not only did the Iraqis have the legacy of Saddam, not only have the total incompetence of the CPA and the U.S. occupation administration, but they also have, they're also surrounded by countries, none of which want to see the democratic experience. So in a sense, the kind of blame game is not to say that Iraqis aren't ultimately responsible for whether or not there's a democratic transition or not. Again, going back to Reeder's point about certain issues not being brought up in the media, very few people address this kind of issue, which you're suggesting by your remarks.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Ariel Aram. I'm at Georgetown. There seems to be a consensus on the panel and a scholarly consensus that the roots of civil war, ethnic strife, are greed and not grievance. But and there seems to be agreement on the panel on this matter, but when you're talking about what constitutes Iraqi identity, you didn't seem to allude to anything about greed as being a factor that could keep Iraq together. That is to say, it might be greed and not national pride, not anything having to do with Iraq al-Arab or anything like that, that makes the political figures stick to Iraq. Can you speak on these questions of positive incentives, as Phoebe said, or as instrumentalism, as Professor Davis said, that might keep the country together, and speculate as to where that instrumentalism breaks down?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're asking, but I don't think I don't know if I would. I'd have to think a little bit about your kind of dichotomy between greed and grievance. I don't think that greed actually is going to contribute in any way to the unity of Iraq. Quite the opposite. I think it's going. If you look back at the Balkans, and you read a book like V.P. Gagnon's The Myth of Ethnic War, and you see the extent to which oftentimes ethnic entrepreneurs, as he called them, actually assassinated moderates, you see that one of the components that goes along with sectarianism is to make sure that you establish tight vertical boundaries between ethnic groups with very porous boundaries, so that you want to eliminate people like professors, and they're being killed, journalists who are arguing for cross-ethnic cooperation. So I would see that in terms of greed, it's in the interest of these sectarian entrepreneurs to try to prevent people from acting in cross-ethnic ways, because that undermines both their political power and it undermines also their economic power. And it's very interesting that a friend of mine who is the president of the Iraqi American Chamber of Commerce, who was kidnapped and wrote an article about his kidnapping that appeared in the Los Angeles Times, was in a room in which half the room was divided up between, you could say, ideology or grievance versus greed, to use your dichotomy. On one side were Sunni insurgents, or suspected or accused insurgents, who were there and were going to be executed. On the other side was a large number of people like himself who were being sold for as much ransom as they could get. So I think this kind of metaphor of this room in which half the people were going to be killed and the other half were going to be sold back to their families or corporations or whatever is indicative of the fact that this is not the kind of strategy to lead in any way, shape, or form to national unity.
Phoebe and then Nabi.
I would take a little bit different point of view. I don't know whether this is working. Greed, of course, has a bad connotation, and it sort of conjures up what we have there now, everybody out for himself and tapping into the oil and parties trying to get as much money as they can. But I would put it in a different context. It seems to me that particularly with Iraq's main resource, oil, for those leaders who are thinking more responsibly, there is more to be gained by staying in Iraq, keeping Iraq together, if you like, than splitting it apart. This is particularly true for the Kurds, because the oil wells in Kirkuk, should Kirkuk come into their region, they don't even have that region now, is less than those in the south. And even for the people in the south who are on the Basra oil fields, as I said before, to get the oil going and the economy going, everyone knows it's going to take billions of dollars, and the kind of money and expertise that really only big companies can put in. That's just not going to happen in an Iraq in turmoil, which sovereign status is not clear. So there is more to be gained by Iraqi sharing their main resource. And I think the trick here is to be careful that oil doesn't become a bone of contention, that it becomes something in which people can have a buy-in share. So I think that that's very important. And I would say again, in looking at the leaders, I was really struck, with the exception of the Kurds recently, at how little economics figured in their thinking. And the reason for that is that they're obsessed with politics, getting and keeping power. But their population underneath, it's very clear, puts, you know, not only economic development, but security and jobs first. And somewhere along the line, as we saw already in Kurdistan, there's going to be an intersect here where they're not going to be able to get and keep power unless they can satisfy some of these basic needs.
I'm just going to insert a point of information that when people talk about the Kurds and the potential for Kurdish separatism and Kurdish oil, what's been left out of the American discourse too much is the fact that, Iraqi Kurdistan is landlocked. Basically, it doesn't matter how much independence you have over the oil in your own area if you don't have the buy-in of all the states around you, including what would be the rump Iraqi state, then it's all theoretical.
And then on the idea of positive incentives, not so much greed, because I'm not sure that that's constructive, at least I can't imagine in a way I can think of it as being constructive in this, but the idea of positive incentives for people wanting to stay in a larger entity called Iraq instead of smaller entities, another point that I'm thinking of is, first of all, those smaller entities, and this was raised by Radar a bit, you don't necessarily know that they're actually going to be better for those who live in them than the old Iraqi state was. I mean, there are a lot of grievances against the highly centralized Baghdad dominant state. That's true, but are the new microstates going to be any better in human rights? Are they going to be any less patriarchal? Are they going to be any more democratic, to use an overused word? That's one thing that's sort of a negative incentive, I suppose, vis-a-vis why there would be incentives to have a larger state. You don't know that the smaller ones are going to be any better. But the other thing is, in sort of international relations terms, the smaller the states are, the more they can get pushed around by the larger neighbors that still exist in today's world, may not in tomorrow's world. And it gets harder to band together to oppose invasions from halfway around the world. If they're not going to band together, then they're just going to fall very prey to larger powers like ourselves.
My turn? I can't reach this. I'm much too short for this microphone.
We can hear
well,
you.
Well, anyway. Just don't worry about it. You can hear me anyway, right? I'm Judith Yaffe, and I've worked in Iraq for a couple of years, and I'm at National Defense University. And I'm often put on the spot and asked, well, okay, fine, but what should we do about it? So my challenge to you is to tell me, and all of us, what do we do about it? Because I agree, there's a lot of consensus here. And Michael, I'm a fan because I'm really delighted. You made some very important points, and I have total agreement with what you said. And I think that you've all raised important points. But what do we do about it? How do you get the Kurds to compromise? How do you create a national army, especially when the Kurds won't let any non-Kurdish military into the north and are paying the salaries of the Kurdish military in the so-called national army, which means that they get, I think we call that double dipping it at home. I've heard the Iraqis describe it as a bonus. They simply get a bonus. How do you create loyalty to the state? Because isn't a lot of the problem, whether it's the militias or the military units, and with some we've done better than others, but who's the loyalty to? At the end of the day, are you loyal to your militia, your religious leader or your political leader, your cleric, or are you loyal to some state that somehow has retreated from everyone's mind and you're not sure that where that plays? How long does it take to create that kind of loyalty? Is it now become a tradition that Iraq will always have a Kurdish president Nobody told Jalal Talabani that he was only going to get the one shot at it. Do you always have Shia prime minister? I know it depends on the election and the outcome of the percentages, but in we're creating some new facts on the ground here that may be hard to change later, that you've got to have one from each sect in each high post, and then have under them deputies from the other sects and groups. This does not make for merit, good politicians, for, I think, a good government. There are no independent civil servants. I think we're still going to be there a year from now. So the question becomes, what can we do to become part of the solution and not part of the problem, as we seem to be? But basically, you got your 5 minutes with the administration or with the Baker-Hamilton Commission or anybody. What do you tell them?
Everybody.
Everyone in this.
I'll take a few shots at it. Let me start with the Kurds. The Kurds are far less unified than oftentimes they're portrayed. I mean, look, Barzani's just waiting for Talabani to die. Talabani is old. He smokes too much. He drinks too much. He eats too much. He talks too much. And it's one of the big unknowns that are out there. It's all well and good to have a unified parliament, but if that parliament in reality has no power, doesn't meet, doesn't debate, then that unity is in theory only. Likewise, if the idea of combining a cabinet in Iraqi Kurdistan is to have an interior minister and separately a state minister for internal affairs so that you don't have to make high compromises, it's a real issue. Iraq is still all about patronage, especially Iraqi Kurdistan. There's no easy solution. There's no magic formula. We're not going to see a solution to this in a year. We're talking about strategies which might start Iraq down the line of repairing some of the damage, some of the trends which we see now. When it comes to Iraqi Kurdistan, there's the issue which we don't look at of incitement. It's all possible. It's all well and good to sit there and watch Iraqi Kurdish television and hear 20 minutes, 25 minutes out of a half-hour broadcast on the issue of let's become independent. And I'd argue what some of the Iraqi Kurdish leaders are doing is what I would call the Yasser Arafat strategy of negotiations, which is engage with the United States, engage with the outside world, but don't prepare your people for compromise. And then if concessions are demanded, throw up your hands and say, I'm sorry, our people won't stand for it. Ultimately, this backfires and it creates chaos. I'd argue it's irresponsible not to crack down on some of the incitement now. Now, this is where I'll get into arguments with the rest of the panel. I'm not going to bring up issues of debathification versus rebathification. I'd still strongly defend debathification and so forth. That said, I'm not so sure that a political magic formula compromise is out there. If you survey all of Iraq's population, Iraq is one of the few countries, however you define the constituent groups, that has around 228% of its own population. People haven't dealt with reality. People haven't dealt with this idea that maximalism isn't going to work. That said, with every election and with the longer the new political process continues, the harder it becomes to revert to the old political situation. Those who want to revert to the past increasingly realize that just ain't going to happen. The last thing I would just reiterate, I've talked a little bit about my presentation, about the key issue would be with regard to how are we going to train and professionalize the Iraqi police. That's going to take years. The last thing you'd want to do, Judith Yaffe brought up the Baker-Hamilton Commission. I'd argue that in the Middle East, Secretary of State Baker, who's a very able diplomat, has two main legacies. One is the Taif Accords, and the second one is the 1991 decision not to come to the aid of those Iraqis rising up after President George H.W. Bush on February 15, 1991, called on the Iraqi people to come up. And if our legacy is cemented as basically abandoning people to whom we've made promises, I'm afraid that in the long term, there's no way we're going to be able to salvage anything. This idea that if we just pull back, if we have a phased timeline, if we create a vacuum, neutral parties will come in, or the Iraqis will come to their senses, and the most responsible parties will come to the top, I'm afraid is fiction. And lastly, what I'd say is all too often, theoretically speaking, what the problem of both, I'd argue, U.S. policymakers has been, and also, for that matter, United Nations policymakers or other international policymakers, is it's all well and good to sit down around the table with Iraqi politicians or Iraqi figures and come up with a strategy of where we want to be and where we want to get to and how to get there. That's not enough. It's also important to recognize that many of Iraq's neighbors want to see Iraq fail for different reasons or have different visions of success. It's not enough to have our own strategy. We also need to have a strategy to basically shut down and stop the plans of our adversaries. In Bosnia in 1992, when people were afraid of Iranian Revolutionary Guard interference, at some point that meant drawing a red line, forcing an Iranian Boeing 747 down in Zagreb to illustrate to the Iranians that there wasn't going to be open-ended shipments and interference into Bosnia. We haven't yet drawn our red lines clearly in Iraq, and first and foremost, that's what we need to do.
Phoebe?
I think Michael's brought up a couple of things. I agree with most of what he said, but maybe we can throw a couple of other things in the mix. I don't think there is much that we can do. As Michael said, we can sit around and we can come up with thoughts about how to get stability and improve things. But my sense, looking at the leaders, again, and the people who are doing this, rather than the population, which is fed up, is that they're not through with the struggle. This is a struggle for power. The old regime isn't coming back. There may be some of those folks out in the Sunni Triangle who think it is. They've got a chance to work at it. There is no magic bullet. There are no series of things that we can do that are going to right the situation. Either we're going to stay there, and I'm not advocating all of these troops for another 5 to 10 years, but we're going to make a commitment to support and help a situation and have some patience, because their timeline is different than our timeline, to nurture and encourage the sorts of things we've said today. Or if we pull out and so on, we're going to have a real mess there. You think it's bad now, but it could get very worse. The best thing that I think that we can come up with are some steps that we could take to encourage helping Iraq stay together, because that's what the panel was about, nurturing stability and some kind of outcome that most Iraqis themselves would find acceptable. First of all, we need a government, not only at the center, but also in the provinces. At the center, I can think of a couple of things we could do. This idea that Nouri al-Maliki has been there for how many months now, and gee whiz, he hasn't solved the problem, we need to get rid of him, this sounds mind-boggling to me. What you see is what you've got. You're going to have to work with it. In order to encourage a stronger, more effective central government, it doesn't look to me like the cabinet is functioning as a cabinet. You could work with the National Security Council, which does bring all of the major parties together and is a little bit more focused. I personally would, secondly, talk about staffing. One of the problems is that you've got all these politicians who are functioning at a political level. There is no civil servant. The ministries are acting like fiefs. The middle class is evaporating. Difficult though it is, there are plenty of really good educated Iraqis. Maybe they're not in Baghdad today, but the extent to which you can staff the prime minister's office, the cabinet, get middle class practitioners in there to help stabilize the situation is something that needs to be done. But there's no magic bullet. I've suggested once again that we're seeing something emerge there, and that is, even if you don't like them, certain political parties, which could change, which could evolve. And there's nothing better than taking each issue at a time and trying to get some kind of reasonable settlement. There just isn't any magic bullet, and frankly, I think our expectations are out of whack. Nothing is going to happen in the next 6 months, probably not an awful lot in the next 2 years. It may get worse before it gets better, but if we're not willing to sort of stick with it and encourage the steps that we want to see, you're going to get something far worse.
Nabi?
I'm thinking about both of the positions I'm hearing so far, and this is where I do start to differ with Michael, I suppose, on a couple of points. One is you said earlier that you don't really see any role for the neighbors in Iraqi society because Iraqis reject foreigner interference. And while in a sense I agree, each of the neighbors do have portions of Iraq that are supportive of them and their interests, and vice versa. So it'd be complicated to give examples, but you know, Turkey does have a role to play in Iraq with various parties in Iraq, and Iran does as well, and so do, for that matter, the Saudis, Jordanians, and Syrians. And as a result, one of the things that I kind of liked in this last USIP report, which is out there on that table, is it's a very pessimistic report, by the way, extremely pessimistic, called Scenarios for the Insurgency in Iraq, October 2006. It's brand new. The one that's called Neighboring Helping Hands, where you sort of bring in the neighbors and you reduce the American profile and you increase the regional profile, be it militarily, diplomatically, politically, financially, what have you, it's extremely complicated. That would be the diplomatic equivalent of, I don't know, proving the theory of relativity. It's an impossibly difficult thing to imagine, but that is the solution that I would advocate if I were God, if I were the one in charge of such things. And that implies, on my side, something of a drawdown of the U.S. military presence. And that's both political and sort of a policy prescription. As I see it, the U.S. presence is not really helping the situation. I think it's exacerbating the situation. I think it has been from the very beginning. And also sort of politically, the argument originally was weapons of mass destruction, and then there was a secondary argument of getting the president at the time out of power. Both of those goals have been achieved. If the U.S. presence is to continue, then that implies that the U.S. has some other interest in being there. At least that's how it's being seen by Iraqis. And so I would actually draw it down. So I'm that's my prescription.
Ryder and then Eric, but I would also like you to keep in mind the question of how do you get the Kurds to compromise, and how do you recreate or achieve loyalty to the state? How long will it take? Those kind of prescriptive frameworks.
Well, I'm not going to say anything about the Kurds, I'm afraid, but more generally about national reconciliation, I think. And the problem is there is a bedrock of nationalist sentiment in Iraq today, but it's not terribly relevant in politics today. So the question is, how can this sentiment be activated and be made politically relevant? There are various things that can at least push it, things in that direction. The first is there's going to be 18 months before there's any implementation of federalism. So in those 18 months, the central government will have its window to perform, and it must be aided in their efforts to do that. The second thing is there will be a revision of the constitution. As we discussed earlier, it's now unlikely that that revision will reverse federalism as such, but it can do something about oil distribution. And I think it's hugely important that oil distribution is defined at the politically neutral governorate level instead of the sectarian units, which would only inflame tensions. There's no need to preempt the outcome of the federalization process by locking things in the constitutional revision. And the third thing I've been considering is that Iraqi nationalists should perhaps consider redefining themselves as federalists. The problem with the current, with the new law on implementation of federalism is that it gives advantages to those who want to federalize, because if you don't succeed 1 year, you can try the next year. And it can go on and on and on. Now, for nationalists to succeed in that context, you can either sit passively and wait and vote no each time. The alternative would be an active strategy, defining Iraqi nationalism as a regionalism stretching from Basra to Mosul and trying to achieve popular support for that vision. That would at least come in as an interesting competing factors in those referendums and would probably be able to do something about the federalization process in a nationalist direction.
I would build my, I mean, the question was, what do you say? What are your policy prescriptions? And I would build those on what Iraqis themselves have said they want in polls from 2003 right to the present. And the hierarchy of preferences is, first of all, for security, second of all, for jobs, and third of all, democracy, which often means constitutional protection so you don't have a return to the type of repressive and sectarian politics that you had under Saddam. And I would say that in terms of the security issue, that we need to internationalize the conflict, and there probably should be an international UN-sanctioned meeting in which you develop a military force that has a mandate from the Iraqi government and from the United Nations to go in and to take care once and for all of the militias. You talk to anybody in the army, and they'll tell you there's just not enough American troops and not enough trained American Iraqi troops to put down the militias. So I think that you start out with a very simple idea here. You have to have a large enough security force that's going to be able to tamp down the militias. And that is going to help political institutions, and that is commensurate with what Iraqi public opinion polls and my own conversations with Iraqis shows as well. Secondly, I think the elephant in the room that very few people talk about is the economy. I just published a lengthy piece in the Newhouse Papers, and it was picked up in the Beirut Star. I'll be happy to send that to anyone if you're interested. But I tried to build on what a lot of Army officers have told me about the Commander's Emergency Response Program, which was a New Deal-type policy that's been used very successfully. I've talked to dozens of officers who have repeated this over and over again, where funds were taken to areas where there's a lot of violence. People are put to work and make work jobs, but jobs that are important, cleaning up sewage, cleaning up garbage, building clinics, repairing roads. Immediate results in terms of tamping down violence and also leading people there to be very grateful. This isn't rocket science. Our own president in the 1930s came up with the idea of the New Deal, okay? And so I would say that unless you're going to give people jobs, unless you're going to undercut many of the incentives that people have to join sectarian militias, we're not going to go anywhere. And this is something, again, where I think I would agree with Nabil, that you could bring in neighbors, especially Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, which are awash in oil revenues right now, and who do not see it in their interest to have the violence that's in Iraq, which could get a lot worse if we have a precipitous or even phased-down withdrawal and spill over their borders, to contribute to an economic reconstruction fund. Maybe even our newfound friend Libya, which seems chomping at the bit to try to gain our favor. So these countries have a lot of money at the moment. They could contribute to this economic reconstruction fund. And the way in which I tried to envision it in the piece that I published was that after you tamp down violence using a kind of a New Deal SERP-type project, then you try to develop sustainable, not steel mills, not, you know, KBR long-term projects, but immediate jobs, rebuilding bakeries, which have been destroyed because of sectarian reasons, all sorts of small industries that will immediately put people to work. So a combination of security and economic underpinning of the economy, I think, would provide the important basis for then moving towards the issue of trying to move towards democracy. And one thing that hasn't come up today, which I think is very, very important, we've talked about ethnic and sectarian identities. No one has talked about cross-cutting cleavages. No one has talked about social class, gender, education, ideology. I mean, Iraq's ethnic groups do not march in communal lockstep. And we all know among the secular and educated middle classes that there's tremendous intermarriage. And one of the tremendous casualties of Iraq, and I think is very much the hope of the region, are the educated, secular middle classes, that if we do have a devolution of Iraq into chaos and anarchy, and we do have these militias coming to power, as we've already seen, they've been targeting precisely these educated middle class people who are the ones that are anti-sectarian, that are promoting democracy, and that are promoting moderation and tolerance. And these people are going to have to leave the country, or they're going to find themselves executed. And that's going to be, again, one of the huge casualties if Iraq fails. And it's something that, again, very few people call attention to.
Michael, you have something.
I'm not going to argue with anything that was said, whether or not I disagree with it. I do want to underline the importance of the Commander's Emergency Relief Program funds, the SERP funds, the fact that the soldiers were in the field, could see it implemented, could talk to local politicians, made it the best program out there and one that shouldn't have died. That said, with specific response to the question about the Kurds, it's time to play hardball. It's that simple. That there are certain laws on the books in the United States, for example, the Foreign Aid Act, I believe it is, of 1960, which says, for example, or can be interpreted as saying, that the United States is not allowed to give aid if, for example, the Kurds deny people entry into their region on the basis of ethnicity alone. And that all too often we've been allowing abuses to continue. If an abuse occurs once, if there's tolerance once, there will be tolerance, it will continue. Unfortunately, our red lines also need to be with regard to internal norms of behavior.
We have a fight here for the last word. So Eric Davis would like to make a 10-second comment.
I just wanted, because you'd asked about the Kurds and I hadn't mentioned this, and by the way, if you go to the website of the Iraqi American Chamber of Commerce and Industry, they have been fairly successful in promoting business ventures in the Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish areas. They've held expositions in Kurdistan. And I think that economic integration, promoting the kind of middle-level businesses that they're promoting, could be something that could, again, push closer ties between Kurdistan and the South.
I know there are questions still, and I'm sorry, but I encourage you to ask them offline to the panelists, because it's 5 o'clock and we have to close the panel. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you, the panelists, for wonderful presentations.
Thank you, Patricia. Thank you.